No. Georgie Smallbucks, Ray Pete, thank you guys for joining us today. We're a little, I think, earlier than what I said, but Ray, can you continue on that thought? We were talking about Bitcoin, we were talking about inflation, and we're just talking about the general price increasing of goods, and you had some thoughts on that.
Yeah, the interest-free money that has been saving the economy for a few years, I think last at the end of the fall of 2019, it was reaching the point where just free money loans wasn't enough. They had to figure out some way to radically change things, bringing on the pandemic or more wars or something was needed. And I think the basic universal income is going to be phased in gradually with these. I think the checks to the public are going to get more often until finally it's like everyone is on a pension, and that will make savings worthless. And I see that as once you have everyone basically on a pension plus inflation that has destroyed any kind of savings, then you have people under control because then you can just change their pension at will.
And you had a specific time frame. You just said 4 to 5 years, and so that's actually pretty useful to know, I feel like. What makes you think 4 to 5 years?
Just the rate of increasing inflation over the last 2 years or so.
And then we talked about it a little. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, one of the websites you mentioned, Zero Hedge, they keep talking about inflation and you know, they keep saying, oh, maybe people should start buying gold. But then I remember that up until the 1964, the government had actually prohibited people from owning gold. Do you think something like that can happen again?
Well, there won't be enough gold, and it's already tending to disappear. Like the U.S. Won't give back national gold that they were supposedly storing because it just isn't there. People have been investing in paper gold, and I think there just isn't enough real gold left for the price will just go up if it isn't artificially held down like the government has been doing. The price of gold will go up, but there just isn't enough real gold to work as money anymore.
Remember the Senator Ron Paul, the former senator? He, for decades, he kept saying, there is no gold at Fort Knox. They refuse to allow me to do an inspection. They keep doctoring the paperwork. We don't have, we have only 1% of the physical gold that the United States actually claims that it does. Do you think there's any truth to that?
Some Germany and Venezuela, for example, were asking to get their gold that had been stored for them in the U.S. I haven't heard, but I was paying attention to it for a while, and the U.S. was simply stonewalling.
Yeah, do you think there's any, that may be one of the reasons why countries like Russia and China are rapidly increasing their physical gold reserves, preparing for the devaluation of the dollar, basically becoming worthless?
Yeah, I think so.
And we talked about it a little bit, but the idea behind Bitcoin is that it's like finite. There's a limited amount. And then some people are saying it's like it's a lot better than gold. And it seems to be gaining some institutional support. But you think this is just some kind of misdirection?
I think so. Actually, there is nothing existing. It's a belief system. And right now, the changing beliefs about it have made some people very rich. Buying a small amount that skyrocketed in price. But since it's basically a psychological currency, I think it can be manipulated out of existence whenever the world powers decide to.
And so, in your view, is there any way to hedge your bets against the next 4 or 5 years of things getting really rough, monetarily wise?
No, not really. If you have some land in a place that is survivable, enough water to support yourself and some goats and chickens and to grow some vegetables, then everything is good until some mobsters or governments decided to confiscate your land.
So people accuse Georgia and I of being kind of, they call it like a doomer on this subject. But when we talk to you, it really seems like things are not going to pick up anytime soon. And they're just going to get a lot worse. And I know you choose your words very carefully and you think about these subjects a lot. And even, I imagine you wouldn't even want to say things would get bad just because that might be put somebody in a kind of a learned helplessness situation. But I was reading some Lenin quotes, and I think he has a quote about saying, you're like a true friend to somebody if you actually tell them the truth rather than sugarcoating it or something like that. So what is your perspective on that?
There is a way out, and that is for everyone, or at least half of the population, to wake up and actually think about things instead of the prejudices that they've been taught since childhood. If they just start questioning basically every word in their language and thinking, why do I think this? And then looking at what the absence of facts in their belief system implies, that could lead to people asking questions, what can we do about the situation in which a few thousand people are deliberately destroying everyone's livelihood, making them rapidly more dependent, and threatening bigger and bigger wars to keep people fearful. If millions of people start thinking about what can be done, then naturally basic intelligence is going to come up with some ideas.
What about the tactic of Gandhi, like nonviolent non-cooperation? Do you think if a sufficient number of people simply refuse to participate in the system, that will be enough to cripple it?
At some point, if there are enough people.
What would be a few things that would really put a dent into the system, like maybe refusing to participate in social media, refusing to buy things online, maybe?
Just absolute withdrawal from all of the stupid imposed digital systems. Don't buy anything from Amazon. Don't express your opinions on Facebook.
Which would require you meeting people physically, which would, quickly end the pandemic restrictions, because if everybody decides to meet others, you just can't lock them all up.
That's why people are ordered not to meet in groups bigger than 5 or 10. Used to be called sedition if you had 5 or 6 people gathering together on the street to talk about politics.
Was there an actual law like that in Britain or in the U.S.?
In England at different times, when they were very worried about the French or American revolutions spreading.
Wow, so this has some serious historical roots. You know, it didn't come out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm. Well, at the risk of bumming everybody out, I do want to talk more about this, but I do want to jump into your newsletter, Ray. Okay, let me scroll down here really quickly. Okay, so you have a new newsletter. We talked about your newsletter last time, but this one's called Inflammation, Adaptation, and Aging. And similar to last time, what was your motivation specifically for writing this? This seems to connect very closely to the last few newsletters that you've been reading, writing rather.
And it's a step to the next one, which will be how our purpose and intentionality relate to development and inflammation and aging. This is just making the connections between heredity, adaptation, aging and inflammation, and disease resistance.
Can we get go ahead.
Bringing in the fact that the perfect environment is intrauterine, and then various things can go wrong after birth. If you're in a hospital especially, they can intensify everything that ordinarily would take 50 or 60 years to go wrong. They can do it in a couple of weeks. But it's showing the historical continuity between stress, adaptation, and the immune system or developmental system that goes wrong in aging.
It's really popular in the health world to say, oh, that's because of inflammation, or oh, that's because of inflammation. Like, and it's never really nailed down what inflammation is. So what in your perspective, how do you even define that?
It's what a healthy person who catches, for example, the COVID virus does not experience. Their immune system makes them totally unaware that they're has been a virus in their body because the body is so multiply, complexly designed not to go wrong, not to experience inflammation. It has to be a sick and dying person to get in trouble from such a thing as a minor virus or bacteria. Once you're sick, then you're already in an inflamed state, and in that inflamed state, one or more viruses is just another pro-inflammatory degenerative factor. But a healthy person handles resistance and immunity without even noticing it. So the degree of inflammation that you experience with a wound or exposure to irritants and so on corresponds to your state of health.
If one is deficient in PUFA, is it even possible to experience a significant inflammatory reaction?
The experiments with just rats on a PUFA-free diet, a so-called essential fatty acid-free diet, all kinds of tests, poisons, physical trauma, disease, infectious agents, they're just tremendously resistant to inflammation and dying. Something as crude as holding them by the tail and whacking them on the furniture if they've been eating a standard fatty acid proofer-rich diet, they go into shock and inflammation and die. If they don't have a noticeable amount of proofer in their tissues, they are very tough.
I just want to see the ethical committee that approved this experiment. The description is we're going to be whacking rats on furniture. So basically, without PUFA, most of the inflammatory reaction is gone. Is that what I'm hearing?
Right. The PUFA form many things leading to inflammation, but just the prostaglandins are a very powerful amplifier of inflammation. Some little thing like hypoglycemia can start the formation of prostaglandins, and then once it starts, all kinds of things, cytokines and circulatory changes and such get involved.
Right. And then the leukotrienes and all the other things that are derived from PUFA?
Yeah.
Okay.
Could you say something like the moment lactic acid is released out of the cell or something, that's the beginning of inflammation, or is it much more complex than that?
A shift away from oxidation of the PUFA will inhibit the ability to oxidize glucose. And at that moment, you're experiencing a reductive stress or pseudo-hypoxia, some people call it. The oxygen is there, but you aren't using it, and that turns on lactic acid, which represents a reductive state, an excess of electrons, and that transmits the reductive stress wherever it goes. Tends to convert other cells to that same stress state.
And something in your, or speaking of reductive stress and like the lack of oxygen, maybe I'm getting ahead of ourselves here, but the stem cell renewal and the aspect of the what you wrote about the loss of stem cells. Go ahead.
when you stop oxidizing glucose because of either low thyroid or some poison like nitric oxide or PUFA or carbon monoxide, the enzymes simply stop reacting glucose and its derivatives with oxygen. And so the oxygen is still diffusing in from your bloodstream, but it's not being consumed. And so the animal that is failing its respiration is actually becoming hyperoxic in the vicinity of those poisoned cells. And so hyperoxia is toxic to the mitochondria changes the functions of the stem cell. It's one of the things that brings stem cells out of their quiescent state starts them dividing, so that in an injury situation where the cell is going to die because it isn't oxidizing glucose, the stem cells can take over and replace the dead poisoned cell. But if the cell doesn't get out of the way, then the hyperoxia that has activated the stem cells is going to keep the multiplication going and produce a tumor. But if it is continuously in great excess, then you start depleting the stem cells, and then you have no renewability of that tissue. So hyperoxia is an outcome of blocking the use of oxygen.
And so it's in the
Carbon dioxide, the intracellular pH, is that the major signal for apoptosis of a aberrant cell, and also the signal for the stem cells to start differentiating?
The failure to produce carbon dioxide, yeah.
Right. So the presence of it will allow the aberrant cell to commit suicide, basically, to apoptize.
Its pH goes up, activating its own tendency to undergo cell division, then if there's no glucose available because it's being wasted, then that would be the normal thing that kills the cell.
Is that one mechanism through which the acetazolamide drug helps shrink the tumors? Basically,
And previously, you've been asked about like stem cell therapy, and I don't want to misquote you, but you said something like, "I think we're a big bag of stem cells," and so it's more of like the environment of those stem cells than like just adding a bunch more into the system.
I don't think the idea of taking them out of one place and putting them in another is going to do much, if anything.
If you said that the intrauterine environment is basically the ideal environment for an organism, then by extension, once the organism is being born into this world, then if we want to maintain the same level of optimal health, we should live in an environment that mimics the intrauterine one, which is with a lot of glucose and a lot of carbon dioxide. Is that right?
On a high mountain, with a supply of good fruit, for example, your oxygen tension is lower at high altitude, closer to the fetal oxygen availability. If you're healthy enough to adapt to high altitude, then your CO2 level internally goes up and prevents the hyperventilation, increase of pH inside cells that kills them or ages them.
Is there like an optimal range of altitude? Because clearly, you know, just climbing up on top of Mount Everest, just to give an extreme example, that wouldn't be healthy. So it's got to be something more, I don't know, reasonable?
8 to 12,000 feet, I think is good.
Okay.
Going back a little bit on our chat about inflammation, is oxidative stress and inflammation, are those synonymous or interchangeable terms, rather?
No, they usually talk about oxidative stress as making free radicals. But the thing that turns that on is often a block to the ability to use oxygen. The traditional use of oxidative stress has been pretty confused, defining it as just pretty much equivalent to lipid peroxidation and free radical damage.
Do you know who came up with this term, oxidative stress? Because when I read the actual studies, at least the more modern versions, a lot of people are angry in those studies by saying, look, we're administering a drug that blocks the electron transport chain complex and creates oxidative stress. So this term is completely bogus and wrong, yet it still carries on. Somebody must have coined this cultural term and supported it throughout the years in order for it to be so powerful.
I think it goes back to Raymond Pearl and the Johns Hopkins bunch of reductionists, basically an anti-life thing, that the slower you live, the longer you live. Cooling off and being half dead, according to that view, is the way to live longer. Leonard Hayflick was in that line of thinking. Just the most absurd and mechanical view of what life is. He, even though he worked for a big cell culture company, he didn't have the faintest idea about how to do proper cell culture. Their goal was just to produce cells to sell them. And he didn't realize that growing 50 generations in a dish is not at all comparable to the living state in an organism. People fell for that shortening telomere idea that cells necessarily every division shorten their telomere and have a maximum division capability of 50 cell divisions. Back in the 60s, people tested that and showed that our skin and intestine, for example, would use up those 50 cell divisions of our stem cells in just a few weeks or months, and that grafting experiments found that different organs, like mammary glands, could undergo essentially an infinite number of cell divisions when they're in an organism, supporting the Rockefeller University experiments of growing chicken heart cells, keeping them alive for more than 20 years just by renewing their environmental solution properly, not letting lactic acid accumulate.
Do you think some of those ideas of the rate of living theory may have been inspired by the second law of thermodynamics and the steam presses from the England's Industrial Revolution, saying, like, if you keep your machines cooler, they will last longer?
Exactly. It's all mechanical thinking. And that mechanical thinking, like N.A. Kozyrev, looking at the history of these physical ideas, showed that it was a belief, basically, in a Big Bang creationist universe, that those ideas, if you believe there was a creation of the universe in one moment, then you can deduce that one directional running down of the universe. The cosmic, or the idea of what do they call it, a watchmaker, right, a god who set the universe clock in motion. All a clock can do, if God wound it up at one point, is run until it loses the wind-up energy. And so the universe, from that religious viewpoint, can do nothing but run down. N.A. Kozyrev showed that if you don't make those religious assumptions, then you can explain the stellar energy source, the fact that all of the planets have an internal production of energy. Even the giant gaseous planets turn out to be producing internal energy, like an incipient star developing.
So I guess all these people, the religious fanatics, they observed the time passes forward, and the way they explained it was with the Big Bang and the unwinding of the clock, instead of the opposite, which is, I guess, the Kozyrev idea of the continuous creation, which is that there's more time as time goes by, because time is a property of matter.
Right. And even Fred Saadi, the inventor of the isotope interpretation of atoms, even he, in one of his later books, described his thinking for continuous creation. He believed cosmic rays were the atoms just coming into existence.
Okay, so basically time and space are essentially, both are properties of this prima mater, which Aristotle talked about, the pure potential. Does that ring true?
Yep.
Okay.
Jumping back to your newsletter, Ray, and I apologize, I know you've talked about this 100,000 million times, but like the idea that tissue injury kind of invites the virus or the bacteria or the fungus, and they're not necessarily harmful in and of themselves. Is that correct? And then I feel like you probably can't talk about that enough today, you know, at this time.
Yes, and I'm in this newsletter suggesting the probability that the so-called viruses are little packets of nuclear material being exchanged throughout the world by every organism. Bacteria do it visibly, transmitting the information that they invented themselves to their friends. Every organism you look at is actually circulating exosomes, packets of information within themselves in a repair and regenerative process, but all of their body fluids contain those same exosomes and are being released into the environment constantly. And so every organism is emitting these packets that are virus-like in structure.
If an inflamed cell has an abundance of electrons because its metabolism is being blocked by something, could a viral or bacterial infection act as a sort of like an emergency electron sink in some fashion?
When the system is working well, I think that's going on all the time. You can transmit actual mitochondria in those packets.
What kind of exosomes and what kind of things would people be emitting when they actually do take the vaccine? Like, is a question I've been asked many times is, if a person gets the vaccine, are they actually more are they harmful to be around, do you think?
The purpose of the adjuvant, which had always been aluminum hydroxide, was to create systemic inflammation, to stir up excitement so that your body would start making antibodies to anything novel that was present. And they talk about the lipids in these RNA vaccines as transport or mediators of cellular uptake for the RNA, but actually they're the same lipids that have been promoted for use as adjuvant. So they're just a lipid version of an adjuvant intended to create systemic inflammation big enough to get you to produce antibodies. The antibody-producing system I don't think it's properly considered to be part of the immune system. The whole process should be maintenance of our structural functional system. And the antibodies are part of a cleanup system. You have, for example, natural killer cells that will remove damaged cells, killing them so the parts can be removed. When you have a tissue that isn't quite ready to have the natural killer cells destroy the damaged substance, you have antibodies that are helping to mop up and control and prepare, clean up the area so that phagocytes can remove the debris and restore some of the cells to normal functioning without having to kill them.
So if somebody was vaccinated, would that be risky to be around them, or?
Being around sick people, inflamed people, I think always has more risk. In the winter, people going indoors, staying indoors, and breathing the same air. Once one person is under stress, they're going to be putting out more exosomes. And if their exosomes happen to be coming out of stressed cells rather than the normal low-oxygen stem cell sources, then their exosomes can be irritating and spread their inflammation.
What about?
Do you think that might explain why nurses working in hospitals, specific hospital wards, in general, medical personnel that spend a lot of time with those sick people tend to, come down with similar conditions if they spend years in those same wards?
I think so.
And you described like maybe a person being around you, but what happens when a population is like, I guess we're already in a sick population. So can it be that much worse if everybody is vaccinated and, spreading and exchanging with these inflammatory materials?
I think everything the medical system is doing tends to degrade the whole population a little.
Speaking of degrading the whole population, so Ray, somebody you've mentioned on previous shows was Mike Yadon, who's a former Pfizer VP and chief science officer, and a topic that, you know, you and I think first talked about this in 2017, and I know you've been studying it for a lot longer than that, but he said, it's my considered view that it's entirely possible that coronavirus vaccines will be used for massive scale depopulation. And so given your insights of how these things are formulated or how they're said to be formulated, do you think he might be onto something there?
The possibility is there. And when you look at the lying, deliberate breaking of the law of high government officials, World Health Organization, CDC, and the top levels, foundations like the Gates Foundation, you see them deliberately misleading the population. I think it's odd to assume that they wouldn't be trying to execute what they've expressed as their long-range goals, population reduction, since they have the means now, and since they've demonstrated that they are morally corrupt and basically profiting from misleading the public to assume that they're not criminal on multiple levels, I think would be a mistake.
And this is something we've talked about. This is like I'm using like air quotes right here, but like an open conspiracy. It's like the culture of the Pentagon and the CIA and the WEF and all the WHO and CDC, all these institutions. It's like depopulation isn't a radical idea. It's just kind of the status quo. And it's not, mm-hmm. It's not an insane idea among the people that populate these institutions. But when you talk to somebody off the street, oh, they want to depopulate. It's like, what? No, that's impossible. How can they do that? You know, there's so many immediate objections to that, but but what we've talked about before, it's not controversial at all among those people that I just mentioned.
That attitude is exactly what you need to keep them as not believing that it's possible while it's going on.
Didn't Kissinger state as far back as the 70s that basically there can be only one destiny for the third world, and that is extermination at the hands of the powers that be, of the Western powers?
I think that policy was basically decided when Roosevelt died. Roosevelt and Wendell Willkie had a meeting and decided on a post-war policy of bringing the Third World up to the rest of society, making them independent and affluent, prosperous. And right after the meeting, Willkie died unexpectedly of a cold. And then following Allen Dulles's treason, just a few days of the revelation that Dulles and the whole organization were working with the Nazis, Roosevelt died in a very timely way. And immediately the policies towards the Third World changed radically from giving the equivalent of a Marshall Plan to bring up all of the Third World countries to a good standard of living. That immediately changed back to the empire of exploiting them to death.
And then Stalin saw what happened to Roosevelt, didn't buy for a second what the official story was, and that would that explain why the Soviet Union became much more hardline afterwards? He realized what he's up against?
And even some of Roosevelt's relatives agreed with Stalin that it was an assassination.
Speaking of assassination, Ray, do you want to comment on John Magufuli and the very likelihood that he was killed in some way? Tanzanian president, African president?
He was the second African president who had opposed vaccinations, who died suddenly.
And you think
the first one was Mugabe, the Zimbabwean, or no?
I forget the previous one just a few months before, but they were both very antagonistic to the World Health Organization and the vaccine campaigns.
Because African Americans are woke to Western medical intervention, you think?
probably more than other countries, because they've had more horrible experiences.
What, like, this is mind blowing to me, but to you, this is just like, this has been happening forever. These these very critical people of the establishment just passing away instantaneously. And I doubt there's going to be any BLM marches or anything about the death of Magufuli.
No, I haven't heard very much public discussion of it.
Okay, well, we'll continue this chat. Let me do an advertisement here really quickly. So we're discussing Ray's newsletter, which is available by email now. It's $28 US, and you can send that to Ray Peets with an S, newsletter@gmail.com. You can also order books by Ray, his Generative Energy book, 1994, From PMS to Menopause. When was that written, Ray?
In the early 80s, I think it was.
80s, and then Nutrition for Women, 1973, and then I'm blanking on Mind and Tissue, too. When was that written?
1973 was when I wrote Mind and Tissue, a little before Nutrition for Women, I think.
Okay, so you can send that email address and the name of the book, and I still have the wrong prices on here, so they should be cheaper. And then, which, like last time, I just wanted to mention Progesti from Kenogen, and you can email Catherine at Kenogen@gmail.com. And each bottle is 3,400 milligrams of progesterone. And Ray, just want to maybe comment on your thoughts on Progesti.
more men are starting to use it, and you've probably heard the result of the injecting, I think it was micronized progesterone, subcutaneously in men who were infected seriously with COVID.
Yeah, yeah, we talked about it a little bit last time.
A study ended and was published finally that it did improve their survival. So that is increasing the interest of men in using it. I had probably discouraged men for a long time when I described how a big dose of it is like a cold shower and shrinks the penis. But that effect passes in about 1 or 2 days. So with the proper dosing, it actually increases libido and it keeps testosterone from being wasted and turned into estrogen. So it's actually a very important part of the male system.
I'm actually glad you brought that up. So we have a large 20s, 30s, 40s male listenership. You know what? So one, how much progesterone does a healthy male make? And then I know this is extremely individual, but is there any way to go about dosing progesterone for a male? And like, what should they expect when they use it?
The basic mechanism is that it promotes, a given dose promotes its own synthesis in the body. And partly that's because it facilitates the secretion of thyroid hormone, which is part of the conversion of cholesterol to progesterone, and partly because it inhibits the enzyme aromatase that converts androgens to estrogen. And it supports the internal system of getting the vitamin A and thyroid together with the cholesterol so that often during pregnancy, if a woman is seriously deficient in progesterone, one single big dose will sometimes set the pregnancy back on a normal course of producing progesterone at an increasing rate for the full 9 months. Sometimes it takes two injections, but the principle is that when you get the right amount at one moment, your thyroid and gonads and skin and brain, everything gets back on the track to produce enough of your own progesterone. So it isn't a hormone replacement matter, but it's a stress correction process. You stop the stress, and if you're well nourished, the organism gets back to its production.
I have a question. I get a lot of questions from parents who want to or considering using Progest-E in children. Do you have any reservations, misgivings about giving little children progesterone in Progest-E specifically?
Very premature babies, their brain growth is protected, sort of like imitating intrauterine conditions to give them a little progesterone for the first few months of their life to keep the brain developing. That probably can be beneficial if there has been stress so that they had some deficiency of progesterone. That could be a continued right up through all of the time breastfeeding is going on. If the mother normalizes her progesterone, progesterone level of the milk will be adequate, and that will help the baby's brain develop. But if you give it to a boy, just as their puberty is coming on, you potentially, by giving too much for too long, you could delay their development sexually, probably. I don't know if that ever happening, but I think it's good to think of it as a restorative starting up support rather than a continuing maintenance.
Okay. The specific questions I'm getting is that a lot of parents are concerned that during the pregnancy, the mother was under stress, was, you know, received vaccines, was working really hard. So basically they're saying now their children that are born and becoming 3, 4, 5 years old, they're seeing some signs that are indicative of a stress imprint, like the child is gaining weight. And while the parents are normal weight, the child is having food allergies while the parents don't have them. And some of them have had really good success with Project E, and they keep asking me questions. Are there any concerns about using Project E sporadically on a child that's small in terms of, aside from delaying puberty, would there be a problem in terms of somehow disbalance in their hormonal status if it's used for, you know, a few months or so?
No. It's possible to suppress the formation of testosterone if you take really big doses, but when you do it by symptoms, 5 or 10 milligrams a day can alleviate symptoms. Sometimes one dose of 20 milligrams can just cure the problem and doesn't have to be repeated. But you should always go by watching the effects of it, because they are very obvious when you're having progesterone deficiency symptoms, very similar to low T3 symptoms. You should see the results happening within 5 or 10 minutes, or at most an hour, so you can take a drop or two. Wait 10 or 15 minutes, and if you still have the symptoms, then you can repeat it.
How much progesterone daily do you think a healthy child is producing at that age, like before the teens, like a child up to 10 years of age? How much, male or female?
Probably somewhere between 10 and 30 milligrams.
So that would be essentially up to that would be a good replacement dosage if the parent thinks there's like an issue and they want to try it?
The 30 milligrams is a very strong dose. That's the dose that can temporarily shrink a man's penis by blocking testosterone. But 5 or 10 milligrams is usually a very adequate corrective anti-stress dose.
But for a little girl, it wouldn't be, those concerns are not present, right? It shouldn't be an issue.
No, but I just don't think the larger amounts are necessary, because it stimulates its own corrective production.
For a hypothyroid child at that age, do you think progesterone would be safer to try first than jumping directly on thyroid?
No, usually I think it's good to use a small amount of thyroid as if you're eating a traditional diet, eating a boiled whole fish or soup made out of all the parts of a chicken or whatever, that would be giving you maybe a half a grain, a fourth to a half a grain of thyroid every day, just as part of your meat diet. And so there's really that small amount of thyroid should just be a standard part of nutrition. But the government in the early 1940s required the meat producers to remove the thyroid, setting up a situation in which our diet is pretty free of the natural amount of thyroid unless you drink a large amount of milk. Even cow's milk contains a moderate, helpful amount of thyroid hormone.
So, what about fish head soup? They're not removing the thyroid from that, right? I mean,
it'll be... right. That's if you have a fish market that will include the heads.
Semi-related, but I've been receiving more and more people saying they have kind of like wild experiences with Sinoplus. And so if somebody did feel like that, would you say to try a higher ratio of T3 to T4? Would you suggest aspirin? Would you suggest progesterone? Maybe if they were interpreting the symptoms correctly, it being liver related, is that something that you receive messages about?
Yeah, usually the problem is that they don't go at it gradually enough. It should increase gradually over a period of 2 or 3 months, steadily increasing. Watching your temperature and pulse rate and adjusting the dose according to those. If you jump right in with what you think is going to be your dose, that's when you're more susceptible to building up too much T4.
What about, so as we go through time here and as people get progressively sicker and sicker, would you see an issue, a more and more of an issue with a 1-to-4 ratio as people get sicker and sicker?
I've known many people who benefited from going up to about a 1-to-2 ratio, having that little bit of T4 to help hold out down their TSH during the night when it contributes, when the TSH contribute to the stress experience, the bedtime T4 will minimize that, still they're getting a good amount of T3, enough that will keep their blood sugar up so that they don't fail to convert to T4.
Great stuff. Man, I just had a blank. I wanted to ask you one other question about this. Oh, I remember what I was going to say. I have been saying this wrong for 10 years. And you have mentioned it many times. I think because when I go to the Armour website and I'd read what a grain was, it was about like 9 micrograms of T3, maybe 38 micrograms of T4. And so I always thought that was a grain. But now I understand that a Sinoplus, like, is about, and correct me if I'm wrong, about 12.5 micrograms of T3 and maybe 50 micrograms of T4. And then a fourth of a Sinoplus is about a little more than half a grain. Is that right?
Close to that, yeah.
Okay.
And the original Armour thyroid, the ratio in one publication was close to 3-to-1 rather than 4-to-1. Mm-hmm. And they didn't talk about the amount of T4 or T3. They apparently had done it without even knowing the existence of T3 and T2 for so long. They were relying on testing the biological effects on mice. Every batch, they would mix up thyroids from different cows or pigs, whichever it was, and they produced both. You could buy beef or pork thyroid from Armour. Each of them was batch standardized to give reliable physiological effect on mice. So they didn't care what the T4 and T3 content was. It was the biological effect they were defining their grains on. And they would dilute it accordingly with I think, lactose and stearic acid or magnesium stearate to glue the tablets together.
Great stuff. Georgie, if you didn't have a question, maybe we'll take a user, or why do I keep saying the user question? Like a watcher, listener question. Okay. Well, let me play this one. Let me know if you can hear this right. This one's from Sheila, and it's about children and school.
Hey, Dr. Pete.
You can hear that right, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Hey, Dr. Pete. This is Sheila. I have a middle school daughter who is remote learning for about a year now due to lockdown restrictions. And she is understandably failing behaviorally and academically. Good grades, but just we're seeing her fade away. And my concern is, for me moving forward, trusting what our state offers us and our district offers us academically, and how they're going about teaching, and then in the future, just investing in colleges. And I guess what I'm asking is, how do I align my expectations with the reality of what the future is going to look like educationally for these children? Thank you.
I think the thing is to work on trying to get the alignment back to the human concept of what education is. Via a computer, not only a standardized curriculum, but standardized methods and format. Everything is being standardized out of normal human reality. That just doesn't work in the long run. If you accept it, then I think you're strengthening an irrational system. I think everyone has to start rejecting digital education, artificial intelligence, as well as standardized curricula.
This is semi-related, but I heard an interesting theory about the mask, that they're trying to monopolize like human interaction online. And this might be actually completely obvious, but like you don't have any normal emotional interaction when you go anywhere or you talk to people. Those are all now on the internet. Does that seem reasonable to you?
What, the interaction is all on the internet?
Yeah, like if I go to the store and now I can't see the people's faces and have kind of like any kind of emotional interaction with these people. But that's now all on the internet. Like those interactions are monopolized on the internet now.
I suppose that puts people more under the control. If you start having the wrong kind of interactions, it'll be like the censorship of YouTube and Facebook and Twitter. If they heard everyone under their computers, then they not only know what everyone is doing, but they can weed out the ones who aren't doing it right.
Speaking of, do you think the part of the lockdowns was to get everybody in front of a screen and to kind of consume the fake news as it is?
The whole factory system starting 200 years ago was a way of getting people under a central control. Then gradually they realized that that put them together where they had an opportunity to unionize. Mm-hmm. Now the shift to the computer communication, one of the obvious things it does is to make it possible, impossible to have direct contact and organize unions.
Do you remember, I think it was around 2006 or 2007 when Google was coming up with its like virtual reality glasses, whatever that thing is that they put on their heads. Somebody asked one of the founders, like, why would you come up with something like that to mimic reality? Isn't reality, you know, more than enough for us? And the response was, why? Who would want to live in this world? Look at how terrible it is. When you put on this virtual reality device, you go into a better world, and it's better for you. And basically, you are under you have the entire world under your full control. So they've been kind of working on this for a while now, and marketing it the same along the same lines.
The World Economic Forum people have said that basically human teachers are doing a low quality job of teaching and communicating, and we can have the best courses in the world. We can essentially have a monopoly on the courses and the curriculum because we'll choose the best lecturers, put them on artificial intelligence programs. People can then experience all the best in the world, travel by artificial intelligence, have all of these experiences which happen to be owned by the monopoly and controlled to reinforce the monopoly, absolutely making any kind of labor consumer organization impossible.
Do you think some of the drive to really destroy the world around us, at least part of the impetus maybe to turn people off to the real world around them and drive them towards en masse towards more and more digital embracement?
Yeah, that's exactly what Schwab of the World Economic Forum has said, that the sooner we can destroy this old-fashioned legacy economy, sooner people will realize how great it is to buy only online, to study online, to get medical treatment online. Actually has said that Schmidt, formerly of Google and the Pentagon, and then advising the New York governor on how wonderful it will be to destroy the system of actual school buildings and hospitals and medical clinics and have it all done online.
Recently, CNN had a front page article saying, with all of the advances of technology, why leave the house at all? And I thought, like, wow, they actually said it. And they had all these arguments, like, why would you go to the grocery store where all these yucky, sweaty, whatnot people are rubbing against you? Like, why would you go to a sports event? Why would you go to the pub? All of these things you can have at your home, fully delivered, right? Everything online. And you don't need to leave the house ever again. That was front page news on CNN about 2 weeks ago.
Where was it?
CNN. It was front page news on CNN.
Oh, yeah. Well, one of the most horrible lines of the World Economic Forum people is you will own nothing, you will rent everything, and you'll be happy.
Only if you take your happy pills,
yeah,
because I don't know how a normal person would be happy under conditions like that.
Yeah.
Do you think the governor of New York is being used as a scapegoat, thrown under the bus to like prevent the discovery of bigger crimes that went on during the severe lockdowns?
He's a willing conspirator by bringing in Schmidt as an advisor. I don't think is a a fair-minded, good person.
But now, like, they, you know, he was at the forefront of the pandemic, right? He was the biggest proponent of the lockdowns. It was on CNN and all the media 24/7. And now there seems like they're trying to, like, Me Too him. In other words, all of these accusers came out of nowhere. I mean, I don't doubt their stories, but it seems like the establishment is trying to throw him under the bus. And the story is that apparently other states like Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota had, like, much worse geriatric genocide at the elderly care homes, and now they're trying to throw Cuomo under the bus to, like, sort of, like, put a lid on the story, or at least give the public a scapegoat, because if the full story becomes known and how many elderly people were massacred by basically, like, you know, introducing sick people into their homes, the people will just revolt.
They should get rid of him for his actual crimes. But if they can shift the attention to whatever womanizing he was doing, that's a way to cover up what he was actually doing.
Georgie, do you remember? So Georgie and I sometimes trade emails on dark subjects, but something I felt like important that Georgie said, and that it kind of opened up my brain, was that if the public knew what these people were actually doing, they'd be hung out in the streets, you know, and so that's why they need to censor everyone and close down everything, because if people actually knew what like we've talked about it before, the pedophilia type of things. And we were reading really disturbing things. Ray, are you aware of the Finders, the CIA project?
I met the guy. He contacted Blake College and offered to provide buildings for Blake College. And so I drove to that place near Washington, D.C., and met him, and it was a fraud, basically. He wanted us, he didn't say it, he said he would be willing to provide 10 adjacent buildings for the use of Blake College, but then it turned out he wanted us to finance his projects.
You're blowing my mind right now. Okay, so was this was obviously pre them getting caught in the park with those, like, dirty children or whatever?
It was 1964.
Okay.
When I met him. Petty is his last name.
That was, like, way before that. Didn't they get caught maybe in the 90s or something? Or am I the timeline off?
The kids in the park thing, I think, was in the late 80s, maybe 90.
But the thing George and I were, like, the really disgusting part was the parents offering up their children for, and so we had read things.
As a proof that you're part, and you're going to be loyal, basically, you have to give up your children.
Yeah, that's disgusting. Sorry, go ahead.
I don't really understand what was going on, but definitely they were working for the CIA, and he was definitely a sleaze.
Basically, do you think we've reached the point of no return? Basically, a sufficient portion of the American public is aware, or at least deeply suspicious of what's going on. So there's no way to bring these people back into the system as believers. So now it's basically a war of who's gonna basically a fight for survival between the elite and the truly woke.
And the truly woke have to get their act together and stop being so independent, anarchist, libertarian, whatever, that doesn't want to organize. They've just got to start doing some organizing.
One last question. So this is just like you've had, like, lots of interactions, like, secretly, not your secret, but, like, how many times do you think you've had interactions with the CIA, like, undercover in different situations?
I've suspected some and had some confirmed, but you never know who else might be actually committed to them.
So it looks like the CIA has been violating the act against domestic spying for decades. They basically just don't care, right?
And my friend who I met because I became his surveillance subject many years later, after his wife being very drunk, asked her what work he was doing, and she said, the same as always. And I said, oh, what was that? And she said, surveillance. He had never mentioned that. So later I asked him what group he was working for, CIA or NSA or Naval Intelligence, I think I mentioned. He said, none of those. I'll tell you when I retire.
Well, so
then he died.
I see. So just a personal question, Ray. When you go out to these parties, do you drink with these people or do you let them get wasted and then you ask your questions?
No, I don't drink.
At all?
Ray, how quickly did you know the Finders dude was totally full of it when you were talking to him?
How quickly?
Yeah.
As soon as we met, basically.
What was the tip-off?
His sort of greasy manner.
Right.
Obviously, no character, just an absolute ball of sleaze.
I'm glad I brought that up. That's really interesting. Okay, let's take another question here. This one's from, I think, Johan. Okay, here we go.
Hello, everyone. Hello, Danny, Georgie. Hello, Ray. So I have a question regarding the loss of smell and taste people often seem to experience when getting infected by this new coronavirus. I have several friends that have tested positive for SARS-CoV-2 during the last year. And these people are young and otherwise pretty healthy in general. And almost all of them have experienced some loss of smell and taste. And some of them have problems maybe 7 to 8 months later after being ill. And I read that a study had been done showing that 50 to 80% of people that get the virus experience these kinds of problems. And I think this seems to be a real issue, you know. And I'm actually a bit surprised that this doesn't seem to be discussed so much in the health sphere, despite what one may think of the pandemic in general or the restrictions being implemented by different countries. This issue seems to be of some real concern to public health. You know, the people I have talked to suffers from the lack of enjoyment they feel towards food. They lose their appetites, lose weight, and so on. And taste and smell are so important to assess the quality of the foods and drinks that you ingest. So I just wanted to know, what are your thoughts on this? Do you think this is some kind of neurological damage going on? Do you think this will be a case of concern for the general public? And yeah.
Colds and influenza have always affected the sense of taste and smell, sometimes for longer than others, but that type of respiratory infection, very common symptom was loss of those senses. And stress. One of the things that happens in stress is that the metallothionein protein is increased, and it binds necessary essential metals like zinc and copper, as well as any toxic metals that you're exposed to. And I think the loss of zinc is one of the things affecting the sensory apparatus. It's an essential component of carbonic anhydrase enzyme. And I think that in nerve endings and sensory organs, carbonic anhydrase is important for regulating sensitivity, and zinc deficiency has been associated closely with the loss of taste.
Doesn't it also?
Do you think elevated serotonin has something to do with it as well? Considering that basically now we know that COVID-19 is at least a very heavy case, the severe case of it are associated with essentially a moderate version of the serotonin syndrome. And quite several human studies show that when you give anti-serotonin drugs, there is a remarkable increase in both visual and odor acuity.
And one of the very most frequent symptoms of the COVID infection is diarrhea, and anti-serotonin agents such as cyproheptadine have been very helpful for preventing COVID diarrhea. Which is undoubtedly a part of the serotonin excess problem. The hyperventilation syndrome disturbed regulation of oxygen carbon dioxide balance leads to the inability of the platelets to transport serotonin. And so they leak serotonin and increases the systemic activity of serotonin. That poisons all kinds of systems.
So do you think the elevated serotonin may have, in addition to the zinc depletion, do you think the elevated serotonin may have some direct neurotoxic effect that may contribute to the loss of smell and taste?
And it increases the tendency to have blood clots and inflammation of blood vessels.
Yeah, the reason I'm asking is because it's a very common side effect for people taking SSRI drugs to lose a significant portion of their sense of smell or taste. So it seems serotonin does have that direct effect.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned suppressing the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system with vitamin D, but doesn't zinc also have a part in that in some way, shape, or form?
In what system?
Doesn't the RAS, the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system?
I think the stress reaction is by deranging your carbonic anhydrase. Mm. That's going to be a basic pro-inflammatory thing.
Great stuff. Since we started late, Ray, I'll let you go very soon. So let's take maybe a question or two more, and then we'll call it a night. But guys, okay. Thank you so much for hanging out with us Friday. Thank you, Ray, for making this possible. I apologize for starting late and totally blowing the time on this. All my fault. Georgi Dinkov, thank you so much. My partner in crime, I sincerely appreciate it. Okay, let's take... this one is from Ruth. Okay, here we go.
Hi, Dr. Pete. Have you heard Geert van den Bosch's theory of immune escape regarding the COVID mRNA vaccines? And if you have, do you have an opinion on it? Thanks.
What was the first part of the question?
Actually don't. Something's immunoscape. Some person's... do you know what it was, Georgie?
Can you play it again?
Yeah, here we go.
Hi, Dr. Pete. Have you heard Geert van den Bosch's theory of immune escape regarding the COVID?
Geert van den Bosch's immune escape?
Van den Bosch.
Van den Bosch. He's just talking about the standard thing that if you make a vaccine and the virus is everywhere in the pandemic, a lot of the viruses are going to mutate as they would anyway, but the ones that have the greatest opportunity to keep replicating are the ones that have mutated. And so using the vaccine, any vaccine in the midst of a pandemic, naturally is going to favor the mutant versions of the virus, some of which could be more damaging than one the vaccine is working against. So he's talking just about standard understanding of virology, and people have attacked him as trying to promote his own vaccine, but I think his vaccine work was for protecting chickens from tumor viruses, something like that. So he doesn't have a financial stake in this, but he just understands virology enough that he says, why doesn't someone talk about why we don't start applying standard virological principles to the use of these vaccines and stop using them, basically.
Great stuff. Let's do this last one. Oh, go ahead.
One question. In terms of these tumor-causing viruses, do you think these viruses are anything special in terms of having a particular carcinogenic effect, or do you think they're just inhibiting respiration, which activates the stem cell system, and then basically as long as respiration is inhibited, these things tend to turn into tumors? Or are they actually truly carcinogenic viruses?
I think there are resistant individuals to any virus, but there are some viruses that, like plant and animal viruses, both some of them have a greater impact on more individuals.
So what would be the carcinogenic effect from, let's say, like one of the sarcoma viruses that the rumor is they used to kill Hugo Chavez?
I think that was a gene transmitted by a bacterium, and it just creates a very intense inflammation. And I think the proper approach always is to use all of the anti-inflammatory tools that you have, high sugar, aspirin, progesterone, vitamin D, and antihistamines, anti-serotonin agents. I think if you flood the system with those, you have a chance to overcome whatever pro-inflammatory thing you've introduced.
So speaking of flooding the system, now that the mRNA vaccine is essentially turning people into these highly inflammatory producing machines, do you think that vaccine may lead to cancer for some people?
Yeah, very likely. When you have tens of millions of people subjected to it, and already the reporting system for vaccine injury, studies have shown that fewer than 1 in 100 injuries has been reported historically, and already there are reports of more than 2,000 deaths, several thousand major debilitating injuries, and tens of thousands of other reactions. So if you multiply those numbers by 100, you see that lots of damage is being done.
But specifically the mRNA vaccine, unlike the others, which maybe trigger an inflammatory reaction that may last a few days, even a month, this one seems to turn us into machines for producing this inflammatory spike protein, and this will be ongoing. So
the ACE2 protein is our major anti-inflammatory system, right at the heart of the angiotensin system. It destroys angiotensin. And as important as angiotensin is in all of the inflammatory degenerative diseases, if you destroy the enzyme that destroys angiotensin, that's just about the most dangerous thing you can do to knock out our anti-inflammatory basic system.
Wow. Okay. So basically, cancer, here we come. I mean, as far as the mRNA vaccines are concerned.
All kinds of degenerative things. If people keep producing the spike protein, that will keep knocking out the anti-inflammatory system as long as the DNA and RNA are in their system.
So the rapid increase in the rates of, let's say, all kinds of degenerative disease, how do you think they will explain this away? Simply not count the stats and conceal it? Or
Weren't they targeting VAERS and saying it was like... there was something I saw that they were saying that wasn't accurate or something.
That it was what?
The VAERS. Like, isn't that the database of vaccine injury? I saw something from some news, and they were trying to say that that wasn't accurate because it was, there are so many injuries.
The studies of going around and looking at doctors and hospitals and looking up actual injuries, they found that not 1 in 100 of the vaccine-related injuries had been reported. Mm. So even though they've paid out billions in damages, it could have been hundreds of billions if people had been informed that they could and should report their death and injury.
Because there's such specific criteria. Okay. Okay. I'm going to let you go, Ray. Let me read these donations really fast. So Peggy T. Hey, Peggy. Holly T. Should I read them out? Canadian, $10. Holly T. for $1.99. Janet Pack for $20. Thank you so much, Janet. Marado H. for $7.99. I think Australian. Thank you so much. This went. Holly T for another $3.99. Thank you so much, Holly. KT for $19.99. Thank you so much, KT. Michelle for $50. Wow. Thank you so much, Michelle. And Murado H for $5.99 again. Guys, give this episode a like. We have 132 people watching right now. Sincerely appreciate it. Ray, parting words until we catch up with you next month.
Nothing special.
Nothing special. Let's do one last kind of advertisement. Let's let everybody know that they can get your newsletter by email for $28, sending it to raypeetsnewsletter@gmail.com. And they can also order a lot of your books. You know, I frequently talk to people that aren't aware that you've ever written a book. And so I Generative Energy is obviously my favorite of these. And you can order these books in digital form by also emailing raypeetsnewsletter@gmail.com. Can they also purchase physical copies of these still, Ray?
Several of the issues are still available on paper.
Awesome. And then one more plug for Kinogen. Email Catherine@Kinogen@gmail.com. And Georgie, parting words for yourself, sir.
I don't know. I used to say stay sane, but now at this point seems to be, I guess, start organizing. Turn off the TV, unplug the computer, and go outside. Even if you do nothing, I guess you'll be more beneficial than what we've been doing so far.
Very good.
Awesome. Guys, we have an amazing listenership. Thank you so much, Ray. Thank you so much, Georgie. And we will see you guys very soon. Take care. Have a good weekend and be safe. Peace out, everybody.
Okay, bye.
Okay. Bye.